Oh, the upper chamber has.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. The first item on the agenda, I'm going to open a work session on some LC introductions. And I'll give a qualified statement. A vote in favor of introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of a member's opinion or position on the contents of the concept.
Well, Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1030, which is dated 1/31/17, 3186, dated 1/23/17, and LC 3189, dated 1/23/2017.
Okay, thank you. Representative Olson moves to introduce the LCs as committee measures. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Thank you, committee. So ordered. Okay, I'm going to open three bills. The next on the judiciary, I'm going to open three bills for a public hearing. I'm going to open House Bill 2141, 2142, and 2740 and call Representatives Taylor, Peluso. I'm sorry. Senator Taylor, Representatives Peluso and Huffman.
Yeah, he did it.
That was close.
Huffman being a representative.
Yeah. How soon they forget.
I know. We know you're more deliberative on this.
That's right.
Well, did you notice how much more reserved she is now?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Training?
Yes.
She has that
an air of sophistication
aura
or something.
I'm sorry,
all righty.
Deliberate.
Thank you, Chair Barker, committee members. I'm John Huffman, state rep for House District 59. And before I get started here, I'm just going to kind of get on the record up front that we know that there will be some continuing discussion. We've had conversations with Chair Barker and others in the room about some desires to get some wording exactly right on the bills, but I'm going to go ahead with my testimony as though those conversations didn't take place, so don't throw anything at me because I got on the record that we actually did have the conversations and we will pursue them. And Aaron Knott actually volunteered to do all the work, so life is good. I'm happy as long as, yeah, it's just going to cost me more. These bills today come out of our legislative work group on trafficking and child sex trafficking, and we've actually got seven bills entered this session. I think four in the Senate, three in the House, or four in the House, three in the Senate. Been a very active interim work group, and I really appreciate the work of all the members. It's for those of you that may be new to judiciary and this legislative work group that Senator Taylor and I have taken over from the good work done by Representative Carolyn Tomei. There are a lot of awesome representatives on the work group. One of them, to my left here, Representative Stark, has been an active member, and we really appreciate that. The Attorney General has been kind enough to loan Aaron Knott to us, and we abuse him for that privilege. And Justice Brewer has come on board it's probably been about 15 months ago now. Aaron and Justice Brewer and Judge Waller from Multnomah County went to a conference back east and brought back some ideas that we've been working on through the interim. So we've got a lot of great people on the work group, and that's where these bills come from. So having said that, House Bill 2141 and 2142 offer alternative punishments for buyers of sex trafficked youth, so that as a state we can deter individuals through the fear of tangible consequences if convicted of the crime as described by committee counsel. House Bill 2141 suspends driver's license for 6 months at the discretion of the court, and House Bill 2142 requires the convicted person to supply the court with a list of all professional licenses, permits, and certifications and the suspension of all these licenses at the discretion of the court. And that last sentence, giving a list of all the professional licenses, permits, certifications, to the court is part of the language that we had the conversations on the last day or two, and that's largely where a lot of the language and crafting to get it just right will take place.
Hello, everyone. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21. I, too, will just go ahead and read from my testimony so we can get everything on the record here. I want to thank everyone for having us here today, and thank you, Chair Barker, for hearing these bills. This is an important topic. We have children, minors, and adults who are victims of sex trafficking throughout Oregon, and the attempt of the work group is to make certain that we have the appropriate legal structure in place to address some of the issues that these women, we refer to, it's not always women, it's most often as women, we look at them as victims, and we want to make certain that we have the appropriate legal infrastructure to help them. So, for the record here, these bills are based on a concept known as the Nordic model. As future witnesses will testify to, and it aims to provide tangible consequences to buyers, to deter purchasers of minors for sex, and demonstrate that society finds these crimes unacceptable. We also have legal experts, Aaron Knott from the Attorney General's office here, who can answer questions, and he'll be coming up to testify as well. We are thrilled to bring these bills in front of the committee. We are hopeful for a fruitful discussion on House Bill 2141 and House Bill 2142, and we are ready to learn from various stakeholders about concerns or suggestions that may have and see how we might address those after the hearing today. And then for House Bill, we'll wait and talk about 2470 later on.
You want to do that now?
House Bill 2470. So, Chair Barker, members of the committee, regarding House Bill 2470, in current law, one of the ways a person may be charged with sex trafficking is if the person recruits or trains another and also knowingly or recklessly disregards that the victim is under 15 years of age and will be used in a commercial sex act. House Bill 2740 changes the age of the trafficked person from 18 years of age, from 15 years of age to 18 years of age.
In addition, House Bill 2470 provides consistency between this statute and our treatment of juveniles in other contexts by extending the age at which the person can be considered a victim. Again, we have some experts in the room that are going to provide more specific details and can answer questions. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank Chair Barker and Chair Przanski for allowing Chana to work with us on our work group and organizing the phenomenal work, doing a lot of legal checking. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Chana.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carla Peluso, representative from House District 50, the great city of Gresham. I am here today to voice my support for House Bill 2141, House Bill 2142, and House Bill 2740. House Bill 2141 and House Bill 2142 would impose tangible consequences for sexual solicitation, promoting prostitution, or compelling prostitution, simply put, for purchasing sex. These bills move us in the direction of the Nordic model of addressing prostitution, that is, to focus on criminalizing the demand side of prostitution rather than punishing victims of sexual exploitation. House Bill 2740 increases the victim's age requirement for charging the crime of sex trafficking. Currently, one of the ways a person may be charged with sex trafficking is if the person recruits or trains another, then knowingly and recklessly disregards that the victim is under 15 years of age and will be used in a commercial sex act. House Bill 2740 changes the age of the trafficked person from 15 years of age to 18 years of age. Recruiting a 16-year-old to work in prostitution should be classified as trafficking, just as a 14-year-old is. This provides consistency between the statute and our treatment of juveniles in other contexts by extending the age at which a person can be considered a victim. Most of you know that my background is in law enforcement. I was a police officer for 30 years with the Gresham Police Department, my last serving as the chief of police. Early in my career, society did not or chose not to believe that criminal gangs existed, or that illegal drugs existed, or that prostitution existed. Today, we are still battling those same crimes. We cannot bury our heads in the sand and believe that sex trafficking does not exist. Issues related to sex trafficking are at crucial levels. It is time to attach firmer and more creative consequences to those furthering the sex trade.
Questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so describe to me, any of you, what the Nordic model is.
No, I was going to defer to you or our expert testifiers that are going
to
follow
I
us.
I will defer to our expert testifiers. I have a simple answer, but I will defer to our experts. So,
or possibly committee counsel might be able to address that for us. Since she works with us on
Well, I have it right here on the screen, but I'm just wanting to know from you, since it was addressed what the Nordic model is, I'm kind of curious your perspective what it is.
The idea is, to put it in simple terms, is to choose my words carefully, to focus more on the purchaser of sex, otherwise known as the Johns. And so we traditionally, what's occurred, or historically, that a lot of the legal infrastructure is around trying, you know, arresting the prostitute, putting the prostitute in jail. All this, not to say that that is never going to happen again, but the idea is to move it a little bit. And some of these bills, there is a shame component to them, which is true. One does not have to hire a prostitute. You don't accidentally end up in a situation like that necessarily. And so one makes choices, and the idea that something negative could happen in your life if you purchase sex is where the Nordic model, I'll say in layman's term, and again, Chana probably can speak more eloquently to it, but the idea is to hold the Johns or the purchaser a little bit more accountable. And yes, there is a shame component to this. So
follow up.
Please.
So are there other states that are doing something similar to what your models are right now with these three bills?
So I'm going to have Chan answer, because yes, there's all sorts of things happening in all the different states. So it depends on which one we're talking about, because there are seven different bills. So.
Yep. Chair Becker, Vice Chair Olson, and Aaron Knott can get into more of the specifics with which states are doing exactly what. But some states do suspend licenses. Some states, well, I'm not sure, and I would need to check the research to see which states might be suspending particular additional permits and licenses, as is done in 2142. But I can get that information to you. And the age of the person being trafficked, I believe that there are several states that have that at 18.
Okay.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up again, perhaps Chana, whomever, but on what Representative Olson, I think I'd love to see, and perhaps Aaron will have this, is in those states that have suspended those privileges, how has the, what are the numbers now? You know, how much is it lowered, raised, whichever?
Barker, Rep Post, I'm happy to get you that information if it exists.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any further questions?
Oh, I have, Mr. Chair.
Please,
So under this model, it looks to me like what we're trying to do is move away from blaming the trafficked individual who, in many cases, I believe, has not made a good choice to be involved, and towards the more of the offender, what we would think of as the person instigating. Would you say that's accurate?
That would be correct, sir.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I want to say we kind of were joking at the first of this. This is a serious issue. It isn't really mm-hmm. something to be joking about. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker.
Kauje.
J.R.
Ujifursa and Joel Shapiro, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. I'd like to know, would you like us to
introduce
talk?
Introduce yourself for the
sure. J.R. Ujifursa. I'm a senior deputy district attorney for Multnomah County. I'm the head of the human trafficking unit, and for the last 8 years, I've been the primary prosecutor for all sex trafficking and prostitution-related crimes in Multnomah County. I'm also a special assistant U.S. attorney for the Oregon U.S. Attorney's Office, and I'm a federal prosecutor that also prosecutes sex trafficking crimes in federal court. Chair Barker, members of the committee, would you like me to address all three bills, or would you like
sure,
to do
please.
One at a time?
Yes, it'd be okay. Great.
I'll start with 2141, and first I'd like to give you a little bit of background on how our state has not only evolved in the last 8 years, but the national attention that our state has gotten for that evolving way in which we handle law enforcement, prosecution, and sex trafficking crimes. So in 2007, 2008, it was not uncommon for Portland Police, the DA's office, to focus on the victims or the women engaged in prostitution walking 82nd Avenue and arresting them. Most missions were focused on those victims, those women engaged in prostitution, as I think it was referred to earlier, individuals who we have recognized, many of those do not have a choice in the matter. Fast forward 5-6 years, and the focus, and I think the advanced focus throughout the nation and the best practices, is to focus on those individuals, those third parties who promote and benefit from sex trafficking, both minors and adults, as well as the individuals who drive the demand. And I speak at conferences nationally, and I think speaking to experts not only on reducing demand but on sex trafficking in general, the focus is on if we can reduce demand, if we can aggressively prosecute those individuals who benefit from this, and if we can help with services and options for those victims, that is sort of the three ways in which we can combat this problem. So I'd like to talk a little bit about House Bill 2141 and 2142 as a deterrent. There are many studies that suggest, not only from the mouths of buyers themselves, but from recidivism rates, that there is sort of a top five ways in which individuals would be deterred from engaging in purchasing sex, either from a minor or from an adult, one of which is either having your car towed or your license suspended. Another one is when we talk about licensing suspended, letting your or having your employer know what you're up to. As you know, in the deterrence, one of the main reasons for individuals concerned about these two things is because of the publicness of what they're doing. They hide their actions. They rely on their actions being in dark street corners, in hotel rooms, in motels, and other things like that. Both of these things, an ODL suspension and a notification to individuals who have a state license, would help deter and would reduce recidivism for buyers. Some of the research articles that I'm relying on, as well as from my own experience, is Dr. Michael Shively, who studies John Schools and recidivism for buyers, has mentioned that this would reduce recidivism, as well as Dr. Melissa Farley, who also has done multiple research projects on the demand side of sex trafficking and what would reduce recidivism and what would deter buyers. I'll jump to House Bill 2740, and I'm happy to answer any questions, the realities of what we see both from law enforcement, and I'm representing not only the DA's office but ODAA here today. 2740 requires that the victim's age be under 18. That is not only consistent with the vast majority of ORSs on sex crimes in the state today, that's also consistent with the federal sex trafficking or trafficking statutes as well. We identify that a minor is under 18 for the vast majority of crimes in Oregon, and I think this would be consistent with that. I don't see any reason why a 16 or 17-year-old should not be treated the same as a 15-year-old when it comes to being trafficked. So therefore, I think that this change in the bill would not only bring us in line and best practices with around the country, but also be consistent with the other sex crimes in the state and ORSs under Chapter 163. I told Gail that I would also mention to you that there is a defense. It's called mistake of age. That defense would apply. And that defense is if the victim is 16 or older but under 18, that a defendant could bring a case that he reasonably believed that that individual was over 18. That's a defense that applies for most sex crimes in the ORS right now, and that would also apply here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Joel Shapiro. And I want to start by thanking the chairs of our work group that have brought these bills forward. I want to thank the committee for hearing them. There are some new faces on the committee, and I thank you for your attention to this issue. I'll talk just a little bit about my background in the legislative history. So I've been working on the issue of sex trafficking for about 8 years. Starting at the federal level, I served as chief counsel of Senator Wyden. We introduced the first federal bill to focus on the domestic trafficking of minors in the United States. And starting in 2013, I was asked to get involved at the state level on behalf of the Kids Are Not For Sale Coalition, which brings together nonprofits and service providers that help children who are trafficking victims. This legislature has taken a lot of steps forward, and I want to commend them. First, just a small detour on the bill that you heard last week regarding House Bill 2218 regarding trafficking in persons and compelling prostitution, defendants having an elevated level on the sex offender registry. I was not here for that, but there were some very enlightened comments from Chair Barker, Representative Olson, Representative Post. So it shows that this committee has really been learning about this issue. And as JR noted, in the past, when this issue first came in as sort of a public policy matter, the focus was really on the traffickers and how you punish them. And what we've learned over time is that unless you're also trying to help the victims and trying to deter the demand, you're not going to succeed. It's a three-legged stool. And so over time, the movement has really been to focus a lot on deterring demand. If you can reduce the number of people purchasing sex through through sex trafficking, through sites like Backpage.com, you can reduce the number of victims that are recruited into sex trafficking. And we know that a large percentage of the victims are recruited when they are quite young, in their early teens, if not possibly younger. In my private law practice, I represent victims of trafficking. I represent girls who've been recruited at the ages of 13, 15, and have experienced the kinds of things that you hear about through this issue. So this is reality. I also want to just inject one data point for those who are new on the committee. Data about sex trafficking and prostitution is scarce and not very reliable. But in Portland, we have an excellent study that was conducted by Chris Carey, professor at Portland State University, where he reviewed records from DHS and SARC and found that over a five-year period, 469 minors were involved in commercial sex. And of those, 96% were girls, 4% boys. But this is a high number of people that actually came into the system in some way and received some sort of services or engagement. So the number out there that we don't know about presumably would be even higher beyond that. So this is a real challenge, and we need to focus on it. So the bills today do focus on ways that you can deter the buyers of sex trafficking. Now, I know that there are some groups that are going to come and oppose these bills, and without hearing their testimony, it's a little bit hard to respond, but I've heard some of these arguments before, so I do want to just take a brief moment to kind of respond to what I anticipate the criticisms will be. Much like the bill last week, I think the criticisms are going to be on broader issues that don't deal with the specifics of these bills. So when you look at House Bill 2141 and 2142, they deal with four specific crimes. Actually, 2142, I understand, is going to be amended. But those crimes deal with purchasing sex with a minor, commercial sexual solicitation, promoting prostitution, and compelling prostitution. So if you're talking about the issue of whether prostitution amongst consenting adults is sort of a victimless crime, as it's called, only one of those even deals with that. Promoting prostitution, compelling prostitution, and purchasing sex with a minor do not deal with an independent sex worker engaging in their work. So I think it's important to focus on what these bills actually do. I'll talk just briefly about 2740. That's essentially a housekeeping measure. It has, if you look at the bill language, it has exactly two characters in bold. It changes the age of 15 to the age of 18. That's completely consistent with Oregon public policy that victims who are minors, anyone under the age of 18, should be considered a victim of trafficking if they're involved in trafficking in persons crime. So the last thing I'll say is about the Nordic model. This is an issue, like JR, I go and speak at a lot of national conventions, conferences. This is something that's discussed widely. A few years ago, I participated in an international conference at the Carter Center in Atlanta. and we had law enforcement officials from across the United States, including Oregon, and internationally, including the Nordic countries, come and talk about this issue. And it was one of the policy proposals that was advanced by the conference as a whole, that the Nordic model is a good approach. And I think that Senator Taylor did a good job of explaining it. But really what the Nordic model is you say that the victim, and Representative Gorsuch did a good job of explaining it as well, that the victim in human trafficking should not be treated as a criminal. We need to criminalize the demand from the buyers and from the traffickers, the pimps. And so the victims should not be treated as criminals. And these bills do move in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'd like to ask, Portland police used to do the sting operations where they would seize the car, tow the car. And are they still doing that?
Chair Barker, they are not at this time. That is something that has been discussed with their counsel, the city attorney's office. And I think the concern was that that was pre-adjudication. This would be post-adjudication. So there are some due process concerns involved in that. But I will tell you that probably the majority of calls I received during that time was the concern about an individual's car. It had a ripple effect. It was effective for those buyers as something that was extremely important to them. So when we talk about deterrence, we look at things that matter to these individuals so that they decide, I'm not going to go online and search out to pay for sex, because what are the implications or what are the consequences if I do? And having losing your license or car towing or something similar to that, losing your license or ODL suspension, I'm sorry, would deter in that way.
So one of the things that I saw there that really was a real deterrent was everybody on the title had to come in and sign to get the car back. I saw a few family fights in the lobby of the downtown.
Chair, that's exactly right. Washington State does that right now, and that's exactly right. Everyone on the title must be present in order to get your car out of tow.
Some people didn't know that ahead of time, or they would have been deterred a little more. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate where the, especially 2142, where the sponsors are trying to get at, and it makes sense, and I have absolutely no issue with somebody losing their hunting license and their fishing license and OLCC licenses and all that. And I don't even have that much of an issue with losing the driver's license, assuming they would have the same ability to get a provisional license for getting back and forth to work. Mm-hmm. Only part of this that concerns me a little bit, and I'd like to hear the reasoning behind it, is occupational or professional licenses, contractors board, that kind of thing. I certainly don't want to make life easy on folks, and I think, frankly, taking a hunting and fishing license in my world is pretty much the worst. But I still want people to pay their fines. I want them to be able to restitution, those kinds of things. So talk to me about some of the thinking there and where that came from, and if there would be the ability for a very strict provisional license on that suspension for work only.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I don't know the basis behind this bill. What I will say is that I agree with you, and unfortunately we have doctors, school teachers, individuals who work at elementary schools, and so I think that what this is getting at least from my perspective, is educating their employers and maybe taking a look at their permit. I know that there's some work to be done and some conversations to be had, so I don't want to promise anything, but I think that when you ask about things like contracting licenses and things of that nature, I think there's some more discussion to be done about how that would be notified to them and if that would be left up to the discretion about with the board about how they'll handle that. As far as, I think you also had a question about ODL, whether they would be able to have a hardship. I think that would be a conversation. It's not in this bill, and I don't know about off the top of my head whether a hardship permit applies. I would assume it would based on that, and I think your concern about restitution and fines and fees are well taken. We also want to make sure that at the end of all this, they're able to be a member of society who does good things and makes good choices and contributes. So I think all those are good things. One of the things I'll say about the ODL suspension is in every one of these acts that I've seen, it takes a car to get there, right? And so a car is relevant to this conversation. A lot of people would argue it is not. Similarly, in the drug world, right, if you get convicted of a drug crime, you have an ODL suspension. Some of those cases do not even involve a car. In all these cases, we have individuals sometimes coming from as far as Salem up to Portland, or maybe Vancouver, or all around, coming to Portland, driving their car most of the time in order to purchase sex, sometimes with a minor.
And Chair Barker, Representative Springer, if I may address that as well. I just want to point out that this bill requires that if somebody is convicted, they have to provide the court with a list of those licenses and certificates and things that they hold, and that those will be transmitted to the entities. It doesn't say that those entities have to suspend them. So I think that there would still be some additional due process that the person would be entitled to. It just makes sure that there's a notification.
Thank you for that. Chair Barker, Rep. Springer, I'd like to give a little bit of background information on 2142. It was based off of the license and permit suspensions that happen with folks who are in arrears on their child support, and that is a very broad suspension mechanism that can happen there.
Thank you.
I did. Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, JR, I guess I'm kind of, since you've been, you know, involved in this, I mean, for the prosecution for several years, I'm wondering if you've ever had this kind of discussion. And let me start it out like this. I know that how we are as a society on wanting to try to move forward with respecting and recognizing the issue of the need for treatment when it comes to controlled substances. That in itself we know can be an addiction. What about sexual addiction? Has there been any discussion at all along that line on trying to provide some treatment for these guys, you know, when you catch them?
Sure. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson. There has. I also run the Sex Buyers Accountability and Diversion class, which is a school that every individual convicted of a misdemeanor solicitation charge must go to, must pay to go in there, and it is addressed, and resources are given. So that is addressed as well. This is just an additional tool or additional tools for deterrence, because we have identified not only are there buyers, there are frequent buyers that drive this demand. If you were to look at any one of these websites, you would see 100 to 300 ads per day. Those ads are there because individuals are paying for those services. And so this is just another way to deter demand. But yes, the resources and the sort of treatment and classes for addiction is also addressed. And every one of the individuals who would be convicted as a buyer, unless it's a more serious charge with a minor, would be required through the court system to go to a class like that. In addition, if you're convicted of purchasing sex with a minor, the statute requires that you go to more of a longer sort of almost sex offender sexual addiction class as well. So that has been addressed, and addressed both statutorily and also local sort of practice as well.
So just follow up. Hey, so are you seeing that that's effective?
We are seeing that that's effective. I think there are studies that show, there have been other studies in California looking at a larger base. I think Dr. Shively's last study was 30,000 men in California looking at recidivism rates, and that had reduced recidivism. I think it's very difficult because the demand is so great. It's very difficult to get numbers. And as we talk about numbers, you know, our eyes have been opened, I would say, in the last 6 or 7 years, and so we're still looking at numbers, but I think that there are some great studies already done with a much bigger population in the United States that show that this is working.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For your questions. Okay. Thank you very much. Jason Brandt, Jeff Keith, and Molly Keller.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jason Brandt. I have the pleasure of serving as the president and CEO of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. You don't often have to see me here. You have the pleasure of seeing on a daily basis our chief lobbyist, Bill Perry, probably. So it's a pleasure working with Bill, and want to thank you all for your service. We have a special guest here today, and I wanted to provide an opportunity to introduce him. He's the founder and CEO of Guardian Group, which is a new online training that we're making available to lodging employees across the state We're very excited about the partnership. He survived whiteout conditions on his way from Bend today. So I want to thank Jeff Keith, our founder and CEO of Guardian Group, to my right. As an association, we really want to step up to the plate and be there as an industry in support of everything we believe you will be doing and everything that law enforcement is doing to combat these issues. We want to be a part of eradicating this behavior throughout the state. We find that it's very important. We see a lot of interest from the lodging workforce, lodging general managers across the state. I came from the Salem Area Chamber of Commerce as their CEO, and I've been on the job at Orla for 18 months now. And I can tell you that without question that this issue rises to the top for the lodging community. They want to be partners. They want to find ways to collaborate, to use their resources, to be an asset from the private sector to make sure that we're all working together to eradicate the behavior and be there for all of you as elected officials. So here in support of House Bill 2141, 2142, and 2740, and just have the absolute best things to say about our friends from Multnomah County that just spoke. For all the reasons stated previously, we're grateful to be here. So without further ado, our friend, founder and CEO of Guardian Group, Jeff Keith, who is really on the front lines with former counterterrorism experts, providing training on the ground in lodging establishments throughout the state and also outside of Oregon, as well as the online training that we would love to make available to you and your staff so you can see exactly how deep the problem goes. And we have usernames and codes available for anyone that's interested in looking into that online training.
Well, thank you for letting me be here today. I started my work.
You want to introduce yourself first.
Jeff Keith, founder and CEO of Guardian Group. I started my work in anti-trafficking work in India in 2004 after rescuing a number of girls there helping rehabilitate them. Coming back to the States in 2005, I started Guardian Group. And Guardian Group is a counter-human trafficking group that employs veterans from elite units of the military and intelligence. And we go after, our focus is really going after and helping assist law enforcement by training and really focusing on the predator themselves, on the trafficker. As I'm here, our team back in Central Oregon is working on a number of incidents, two of which just came up today, one of them being a 15-year-old and the other a 13-year-old. So this is very real for us in Central Oregon as well. Guardian Group has been working diligently to increase and strengthen relationships and partnerships with both the public and private sectors. One way that Guardian Group is bridging the gap between these areas is the development and deployment of the comprehensive training and educational tools that Jason was just talking about that provide instruction for community members, law enforcement, and businesses that want to help better protect our vulnerable. Our program teaches businesses about sex trafficking and equips them to recognize and respond to suspected incidents. With proper training and with proper training, businesses are in a great place and a great position to identify potential victims, trafficking activities, thereby deterring future trafficking where they can recognize, report it, and fight it. The Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association's decision to endorse the Guardian Steel training program is a powerful statement. Their commitment to take a stand with Guardian Group against human trafficking has the potential to educate and train 166,000 employees working in over 10,000 food service and lodging establishments throughout Oregon. They become our eyes and ears. The Orla's mission is to advocate, protect, educate, and promote the food service and lodging industries. As a leader in the prevention of human trafficking of women and children, Orla's endorsement and support of Guardian Group proves that their leadership and engagement is based upon action and not just words. We applaud Orla and all of you here for strengthening the workforce to understand the impact their efforts have on preventing trafficking and how to respond should they encounter a suspicious issue. By proactively taking such a strong stance against human trafficking in Oregon, Orla is at the forefront of associations across the nation. I believe that the private sector has a critical role to play in the fight against human trafficking. When public and private sectors truly embrace the importance of collaboration in the fight against human trafficking and are dedicated to finding solutions for this problem, businesses become a force for good. And our state, I believe, is positioned to be a leader in this country in disrupting human trafficking. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Molly Kelleher, and I am here representing Youth Ending Slavery, a completely youth-led 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to combating modern-day slavery and empowering youth to be advocates for change. At YES, we believe that youth are a vital force in the fight against human trafficking, not in spite of our age, but because of it, and for one simple reason. We're the same age as many of the victims. The average age of recruitment for sex trafficking is 12 to 13. Given this, we present to middle school students who fall directly into that most vulnerable age range. In my daily interactions, I engage with countless students. Some have never heard of human trafficking. Many have misconceptions, but all are driven to do something because it could be them. To us, human trafficking is not something foreign. It victimizes and affects our peers. When people our age are being trafficked, it demonstrates to us two things. One, that buyers are not distinguishing between independent, consenting adult sex workers and minors who are being compelled to engage in something that is illegal, against their will, and horribly damaging to their well-being. And two, that if buyers aren't making that distinction, we need to decrease demand. This bill will do just that. This bill is about lowering demand so that we can lower the number of people my age and younger who are being objectified by sex trafficking. Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. I urge you to support House Bill 2141.
Okay, thank you very much for coming down and your work on that. It's really, really appreciated. We passed a bill, I believe, two sessions ago that required real high fines, civil penalties for underage prostitution with no excuse. Or by saying I didn't know she was underage. And I don't know if that's been prosecuted anywhere. If that's, I haven't seen any of those fines. We, because they found that a lot of the people involved in that were businessmen, they had fines that started like at $10,000. And we hope, but if it's not being used, it's not deterring anything. So any further questions, anybody at this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Gail Meyer. Mary Sale and Jana Jams. James. I'm sorry, Jarvis. Okay. Handwriting problem here. Or eye problem, one or the other, or both. One. Jarvis.
Mary, why don't you start?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I am co-lobbying with Gail Meyer this session for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I am here testifying in opposition to House Bill 2141. As you know, House Bill 2141 does propose to mandate a six-month suspension of a person's driving privileges upon conviction of four crimes, commercial sexual solicitation, promoting prostitution, compelling prostitution, and purchasing sex with a minor. On behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I have uploaded written testimony as well as a report, but I did want to briefly articulate our position on the record. First, I do want to address the lack of connection to road safety. As you heard previously from proponents of the bill, they were essentially outlining that sometimes cars are used in these types of crimes. However, what I do want to point out, and I think is important, none of these crimes allege a driving element, nor is there a driving nexus required in the proposed statute. And so these crimes are... there's not actually an element that utilizes a car the way that you would see in a driving-related crime, such as a DUI or a driving while suspended, or some other crime where you would where it would make sense to have a driver's license suspension. That does flow into the argument of deterrence. During my almost 5 years of practice as a defense attorney, I've sat down with clients every day, and it's clear to me that the average person on the street has no idea what the punishment for crime is. I think that that's just, that's been my experience, and that's been the experience of OCDLA's membership. People will not expect to lose driving privileges in these types of crimes. So when we're talking about deterrence, necessarily people have to link that there's going to be something that they're going to lose in connection with. And so obviously we're not by any means saying that these crimes are okay, because they're absolutely not. But what we are pointing out is the main argument is deterrence, and I don't believe that there's a very strong connection there between these crimes and the loss of a driving privilege or the loss of a driving right. Another piece that I do want to outline, and this is where that report that I uploaded comes in, we are starting to find that losing the right to drive is a significant barrier to reentry. And so when we're talking about reentry, we're talking about people either coming out of jail or coming out of prison and essentially being able to kind of get their life back on track. In 2015, Senate Bill 969 did create the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. That's I did upload the report. It's the January 2016 executive summary and report, I do believe it would be helpful to review. The reason why I uploaded is the task force did make a number of findings in relation to barriers to successful reentry, but two of them were directly related to a person's ability to drive. The quote is, the inability to obtain or reinstate a driver's license is one of the single greatest barriers to obtain and maintain stable employment, and lack of a reliable transportation can be a barrier to stable employment. And so we are talking about people who have been convicted of different crimes, but these are findings made by a task force talking about what does life look like for these people once they've essentially paid their debt, once they've gone to jail or they've gone to prison and have been placed on probation. The task force did do a lot of information gathering, and the report does know that they found many suspensions were not related to driving offenses. We at OCLA believe that it does make sense to tie those things, to tie the charge for it to have a driving element if there is going to be a driver's license suspension. We are what our belief system is that there should be less driving suspensions not related to driving crimes, not more. And lastly, because I do want to be as concise as possible, we do believe that people who are convicted of these charges should be punished. But what we want to point out is that they are being punished. They are going to jail. They're going to prison. They're registering as sex offenders. And there are also other collateral consequences associated with these convictions. It's often hard to find employment. Regardless of whether you have a driver's license or not, it's hard to get an apartment, and they lose support from family members, friends, and their community. And we understand that the perspective as well, that's what happens when you're convicted of these crimes. But we at OCDLA simply wanted to point out that losing a license, as pointed out by the task force, makes it incredibly difficult for people to reintegrate into society. It's an additional barrier. And so we do believe that people should pay their debt to society, but then we also believe that they should have the means to be able to reintegrate and become contributing members of society again. Being able to be employed, being able to get to that job, that's so incredibly important. And I know that what we have seen as far as bills being dropped this session have a lot to do with hardship permits, like Representative Springer mentioned, allowing people to get at least provisional licenses to be able to do what they need to do. And so we just wanted to point that out. So essentially, OCDLA, we as a group are tasked with helping defendants through the criminal justice system, and we want good policy too. We do agree that license suspensions can be appropriate at times, but we are urging a no vote on House Bill 2141. So thank you so much for your time, and I can answer questions if necessary.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jana Jarvis here today for the Oregon Trucking Association, speaking against House Bill 2141 and 2142. And certainly I'm not speaking against them because we support prostitution or because we support sex trafficking or because we support solicitation. And certainly we understand the value of shame that is purported that these bills would bring. But the simple fact is that there's no nexus between the revocation of driver's license and this particular activity. I think the single point I want to make in all of this is that it unfairly discriminates against those individuals whose livelihood is dependent upon their ability to drive. Obviously, you know, I represent the Trucking Association, and those are our members who need their driver's license, their CDLs, in order to have a livelihood. So the penalty for them would be much greater than for the population at large. In a former life here, with another client, I testified against taking away professional licenses for this, that, or the other, whether it was non-payment of taxes or something like that. It's difficult to take someone's livelihood away, and these particular bills would do that. I think there's plenty of penalties available to you today, and certainly we'd be willing to continue the discussion. But I did want to put on the record that tomorrow is Trucking Day at the Capitol. I hope you take the time to notice that. We'll have some big trucks parked out front. We're going to have some displays down in the Galleria. But one of those displays is from an organization that we work closely with called Truckers Against Trafficking. There'll be some very good information there. And the simple fact is that our members and our drivers are actively engaged in helping to notify authorities when they see this kind of activity happening. And so, as an industry, we're certainly not supportive of this activity, but we're concerned about this particular approach. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I'll be addressing my comments principally to House Bill 2142. I listened closely to the proponents, and they were queuing up phrases of sex trafficked youth and minors and adult victims of sex trafficking. We acknowledge that that problem exists, and it's a very real one. I'll note that House Bill 2141, House Bill 2142, and the more commonly used phrase, the Nordic model here, is not limited to sex trafficking of youth or to sex trafficking in the sense that we think of in terms of exploitation or coercion. It also embraces what we consider to be the more generic form of commonly thought of prostitution, two consenting adults agreeing to have sex in exchange for a fee. And so both 2141, 2142 do pick up the crime, commercial sexual solicitation under 167.008. That is our prostitution type statute without any of its other aggravators that might be attached. So I want to point that out, that this is really pretty broad reaching here, because the whole issue of whether or not two consenting adults ought to be able to choose whether or not they want to engage in sex in exchange for a fee is sort of getting swept under the rhetoric here. With respect to the Nordic model, and I understand, Mr. Chair, that there is going to be a further work group, and I appreciate that. I am aware there was an article in the New York Times recently about the Nordic model. There were some studies done by it, and they are finding that it may have unintended consequences as well. The Nordic model, again, means that you criminalize the buyer, but the seller of sex is non-criminal. And what they're finding is that the law might be forcing women to sell sex into more dangerous situations, because arguing that transactions have become faster and more furtive because men are afraid of the police, women are jumping into cars without first checking to see if the driver is drunk, high, or otherwise threatening. And so they're thinking, again, that there might be a negative consequence on the prostitutes in a way that was not intended. I don't know who Susan Shepherd is. I don't know what Stroll is, but they've uploaded materials on both of these bills, and she pretty much articulates the same thing. So I just want to preface comments by saying this is actually a pretty broad agenda here, I think. With respect to 2142, our legislative committee looked at this. Everybody was a little puzzled. We had never quite seen anything like this before. Section 2 would have a person upon charge of the crime, they would be compelled to give a list of their licenses. Doesn't say to whom, but that's unusual. The presumption of innocence does attach. Generally, the accused isn't forced to disclose anything at that stage. There was some testimony earlier that the governing licensing board, once they received this notification of the conviction would have discretion, but that's not as the bill reads. The bill reads that they would not have discretion. That would be in subsection 4. So we think that this proposal here would require a lot of work, and we're happy to contribute to the conversation.
Hey, thank you. And I would hope then when you do that work, you also might be able to come up with some things you think would help deter the buyers. Mm-hmm. It would be great if you'd have some ideas along those lines. And I'm sure there's consenting adults paid sex, but for the most part, and I mentioned before that in having been the cop all those years, the prostitution isn't the pretty girl movie. It's much different than that. And I had occasion last Saturday to have breakfast in Southeast Portland early in the morning over at 82nd Avenue. And the morning shift was coming out, and they were pretty bedraggled bunch of sorry-looking people. Saw the prostitutes out. I saw people doing the hand-to-hand drug sales, right, getting the meth. And somebody said, where is your life when you're, you know, 82nd Pal on a Saturday morning trying to buy your meth and sell yourself. It's pretty random stuff. But we're really concerned, and this bill really addresses also the bills, the younger girls, which nobody wants out there at all. So anyway, well, thank you. Any other questions? I look forward to you helping resolve some of these issues, the commercial license and so on, is some good points. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. On the issue of the truckers being concerned about this, I appreciate, you know, the truckers against sex trafficking, and there's a lot of good work happening there. I am curious if you think, as a representative of them, if they thought they could lose their business or livelihood, if that would be a deterrent for those who do engage in this.
I wouldn't presume to answer that question, Representative.
Thank you. That's a good question, but also the point being made, unless people know that ahead of time, it isn't, you know, fair enough. As the people who I mentioned earlier, their cars were seized, most of them didn't know they'd have to bring their wife down to get it back at the time. They probably wouldn't understand. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Next call, Susan Shepherd and Amy Joyce.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, neutral on the bill. Just here to raise some of the sort of the agency minutia that goes into things like this, and glad to hear there's going to be a work group, and I'll look forward to participating on that. Just some language in the bill that we think needs some work. It talks about driver licenses and permits that are issued by the department. The department, apart from DMV, issues many different kinds of permits. Are those intended to be included in the bill? If you've got a business that's got a permit and it's a partnership or a corporation with a majority stakeholder in that corporation, are those kinds of folks intended to be included? So those are the kinds of just detail-y administrative kinds of things that we'd like to work out in the work group. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Susan Shepherd, and I'm a writer in Portland who has reported on labor and legal issues around sex work for the past 6 years. And I founded a community journalism program for sex workers in 2011. I'm here at the request of Stroll, which is a Portland-based street sex workers outreach program that is funded by the Cascade AIDS Project. And they couldn't take time off work to come here today. They've got serious concerns about the impacts of 2141 and 2142 on people engaged in sex work. Let me first be clear that our concerns aren't with clients or people profiting from the avails of prostitution. They are with people selling sex and the impact on those people of additional laws targeting clients. There is a large body of research that demonstrates client-targeting laws called end-demand, or the Nordic model, as you've heard already, increase law enforcement pressure on sex workers themselves, despite claims...
Just back a little bit from the microphone.
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
Despite claims they're intended to shift the focus of policing to customers and pimps. Amnesty International last year came out against the Nordic model. It is they say, a violation of human rights to use this model to combat prostitution. Amnesty's position is that sex work should be decriminalized in order to protect the human rights of both people consensually selling sex and people who are trafficked by force, fraud, or coercion. Neither are served by laws that make them criminals or that rely on law enforcement making a determination of whether or not they're a victim or a criminal themselves. The Transgender Law Center is also opposed to end-demand laws, saying that they impede sex workers' ability to negotiate condom use and force many of them to work in hidden or remote places. Laws targeting purchasers also impede the ability of anyone hurt by a client to go to police. They fear prosecution, and they fear that clients will become more violent, more careful, because they have more at stake the more laws are passed against them. Also, while punishments for compelling or promoting prostitution are intended to target clients or people who are profiting off of prostitution, very frequently it is women who are working together for safety who wind up getting convicted for promoting prostitution. Something like sharing a space to work in or paying for a friend's hotel room or answering the phone for her or monitoring her ads online is the same, you know, can wind up as a promoting prostitution charge or conviction. Someone doing sex work who also has a cosmetology license or an OLCC license stands to lose that. What is she going to do for work after that? The definition of promoting prostitution is really broad. It's so broad that a cab driver who accepts payment knowing that someone earned that money from prostitution can be charged with it, and so can a landlord who accepts rent from a tenant she knows is doing sex work. So to claim that laws penalizing clients don't target the people engaged in prostitution is not supported by reality, where these laws can make them homeless or make it impossible for them to work safely. All of the crimes that are targeted here, they all have existing punishments, from Class A misdemeanor for solicitation to a Class B felony for compelling. If someone convicted of these is expected to pay off their fines, which from the high end go from $6,000 for misdemeanor solicitation charge to $250,000 for a compelling conviction, allowing them the means to earn a legal living would seem to be an important component of collecting. I would ask that if you feel there are surplus resources in an existing emergency, that those resources are better spent on victim services than on creating additional punishments for crimes that already have punishments. I would hope that you vote no on these bills, and I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Ma.
Listening there for a moment, I found myself wondering, are you suggesting that any kind of criminalization of sex work at all should be eliminated?
The position of Amnesty International that I'm citing, that's their position, which is laws that prohibit prostitution, that prostitution itself needs to be decriminalized, that people need to stop being arrested on prostitution charges, period, yeah.
Okay.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, well, we'll close the public hearing, and I look forward to when the groups get together and come up with hopefully some solutions that'll work. We'll see you again. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2609.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2609 is an update to the Oregon Nonprofit Corporation Code. This code was enacted in 1989, and it governs the structures, duties, and functions of nonprofit organizations in Oregon. There has been a work group led by the Oregon State Bar for the last 3 years on this code, and it is a meaty and interesting bill that I hope we hear lots about today.
Okay. Susan Geary. Susan Bauer. Oh, Susan. Yeah, okay.
Chair Barker, members of the committee,
Thank you for having us here today. My name is Susan Gary. I am a professor with the faculty of the University of Oregon School of Law, and I served as chair of the work group that was a work group of the nonprofit organization's law section of the Oregon State Bar. As Ms. Newell just said, we've been working on this bill for about 3 years. Our work group included practicing lawyers, both with large firms and solo practitioners, who had worked with a variety of nonprofit organizations. We had participation from the Attorney General's office, including Assistant Attorney Bauer, and the Executive Director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. So we tried to have a broad representation on our committee and had lots of fruitful discussions over 3 years. We've heard recently some concerns expressed, particularly in connection with unions, and I wanted to let you know that in our deliberations and discussions, we weren't thinking about unions as being affected by this bill. Most unions, our understanding is that most unions are not organized as nonprofit corporations, but there is at least one union in Oregon that is. And we have reached out to the folks who have expressed their concerns and suggested that we talk with them after this hearing and plan for some more discussion about what might be ways of improving this bill. I thought you have the written testimony that section by section. I just want to highlight a few things that we worked on. The purpose of the bill was to modernize and clarify Chapter 65. It hadn't been addressed in any comprehensive manner since 1989. And so a lot of our work was simply that, modernizing and clarifying. There were provisions of the bill that were unclear or ambiguous. The notice provision provided for teletype, which seemed a little bit outmoded, and there were a few things like that that we wanted to do. With respect to notice, we wanted to provide for electronic notice, and our concerns throughout as we were attempting to figure out ways of incorporating particularly electronic methods of doing business was to make sure that the purposes behind the requirements, for example, for notice or for meetings, were maintained, and that we wouldn't do something that would undermine the purposes of those, but allow the nonprofit organizations in Oregon to have the use of electronic means of providing for notice, of holding meetings. I guess those are the two main things that we were looking at with again, those protections. One of the things that we discussed a lot is the confusion that exists about members in nonprofit organizations, particularly charitable nonprofits. There is a box to check on articles of incorporation when they're filed that asks if the organization has members. And for a lot of people organizing a charity, the assumption is, well, yeah, of course, we want members because they pay dues, and that's a good thing. And there's confusion about the role that members have if they are legal members and therefore have the right to vote. And again, the concern here is primarily with charitable organizations that may have been started with members and then, without really realizing that the members were supposed to be voting all along, have moved away from having their annual meetings and having the elections of directors that they should have had. So we wanted to do a couple of things to try to address those concerns. We provided that members, that current law provides that members, that an organization has members unless the articles provide otherwise. We switched the default. So the default will be that a nonprofit organization does not have members unless the articles provide that it does. There is more clarity about how members take action in the bill, and we did include a procedure in lieu of annual meeting. We were told that for a lot of organizations with large numbers of members, the annual meeting had become not very effective. The goal of an annual meeting and the reason for the requirement in the statute is to provide a time for the organization to get information to members, to provide an annual report, and to give members a chance to vote on anything that should come before the members, typically the election of directors, but possibly some other actions. And the new procedure would allow the organization to provide the written report to the members, either electronically or delivered by mail or in some other form, to provide that information and then to allow for election by ballot, by mail or electronically. That would be permitted as in lieu of the annual meeting, and the hope is it would be a more effective way to both to get the information out but also to hold those elections. With respect to the directors, we added a couple of things. We want to make it clear that directors can meet by email, but we wanted to have some rules about what that looked like. What we heard was that organizations think that directors can meet by email already, and they actually can't under our statute. So we wanted to provide rules that would set guidelines for, or actually requirements for how that process would have to be accomplished if a meeting were held by email and vote were taken by email. And then with respect to both directors and members, the organizations need to keep information about directors and members. Those lists are public documents. And we heard a concern that if the list includes physical addresses of members or directors, anyone who is concerned about personal safety for reasons of domestic violence or for other reasons is at risk if that information is public. So we wanted to provide alternative. We want to make sure that communication is maintained between the organization and members particularly, but we wanted to provide alternative ways of making that communication happen. The communication is then left up to the individual director or member, the type of address to be used, and that allows someone with personal safety issues to provide some other address. I would think email might be commonly used. One last thing to note is that although the bill applies and the chapter applies to all nonprofit corporations in Oregon, there is a provision that says that if there are conflicting rules in other statutes that apply to homeowner associations, condominium associations, or timeshare estates, those are carved out, the rules in those other statutes would apply in the case of any conflict between our rules and rules in those other statutes. And with that, I think I'll end. I'm happy to take questions, and my colleague, Ms. Bauer, is also going to speak.
Okay, we'll go ahead, Ms. Bauer. You can go ahead first, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Chair Barker and committee members. I'm Susan Bauer with the Charitable Activities Section of DOJ. As many of you know, the Attorney General's Office has the responsibility of supervising charitable organizations and fiduciaries in the state. The Charitable Activities Section does that. We enforce the rules and regulations regarding nonprofits and charities, including those in Chapter 65. Two members of the Charitable Activities Section participated with a group to make sure that the AG's authority was understood and that the AG had input on some of the regulations regarding nonprofits and charities. So the proposed changes, we think, are positive. I do think they modernize many of the provisions of the statute, and they clarify a number of rules regarding the AG's authority. Most of the AG's authority stems from common law and is found in a lot of other places besides Chapter 65. So we incorporated some provisions so it's all located in one place. I think it'll be clearer and easier for most practitioners and the court. For example, right now, Chapter 65 only references the ability of the AG to seek the appointment of a receiver for an organization in a so long as there is a proceeding for dissolution. However, there are many situations where we think that the appointment of a receiver may be appropriate because the organization could be an ongoing concern. And we don't necessarily think that dissolution is the best resolution for the nonprofit. There is authority to do that under other statutes, under the common law, under the ORCPs, but it's somewhat cumbersome. And so we think that by adding that provision in this chapter, it makes it clear that the AG could request the appointment of a receiver at any time, including dissolution. Another sort of technical update modernization is that we changed the venue provisions. Right now, all proceedings which the AG brings have to be brought in Marion County. That may have been a nod to the AG's office in Salem, but the reality is that the Charitable Activities Section is based in Portland.
most of the nonprofits are operating in the metropolitan area. We now have over 20,000 charities registered with our office, and that does not include religious organizations, which are not required to register with our office. So that requiring all the actions to be brought in Marion County are inconvenient, and it also raises a problem because sometimes we're bringing an action against the corporation, but we also want to name the individual directors who may be responsible for some malfeasance. Under other rules, ORCPs and statutes, you have to bring those claims, you know, where the person resides or conducts their business. So it's difficult to combine those two actions. So by updating those provisions, it makes our enforcement a little bit easier. We also think that clarification of the membership rules and the default of having an organization be formed as a non-member is appropriate. We get many calls about confusion about members' rights, and we do see it quite often that people formed a membership organization without any understanding of what a membership organization is or what members' rights under the statute are. They believe that supporting patrons, being a patron of the museum, of OPB, whatever it is the equivalent of being a voting member under the law, and that's not correct. So we think that making those clarifications would be useful. Also, the statute provides the rules about membership, voting, and so forth are simply default rules. The organization is always free in its articles and bylaws to have stricter, higher standards or different standards. Fortunately or unfortunately, many people get their bylaws from, especially for new nonprofits that are forming small organizations, they'll get their bylaws from an internet site or something like that, and they'll be very generic and won't address many of these issues that arise. And so the statute is simply a safeguard and a backup in those situations. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Vile?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you point me to the HOA carve-out?
Sure. Representative Vile, Chair Barker, it is ORS 65959.
Okay, so that's an existing?
Yes, and we haven't changed that. That's not in the bill, so
okay.
That's in the
existing. That's what I thought. So it hasn't the problem with that HOA carve-out is that for the last 30 years, we've had this conflict between Chapter 100, Chapter 94, and Chapter 65, and it's often not clear which of those trumps. And in many cases, the courts have surprised us with finding that one or the other trumps. Would you agree with me that HOAs just no longer really fit what has evolved as our nonprofit corporation environment in Oregon?
Boy, that would take some more work on my part. In my work, I teach nonprofit organizations, but I focus on charities, and so I would need some more work to look at that. I don't know.
I'm afraid I have to have the same answer. We do not supervise and register mutual benefit organizations. So currently under the law, there are three types of nonprofits that can be formed under state law. Public benefit, which is your typical charity, the mutual benefit, Oregon State Bar, or a religious entity. So we supervise the public benefit and the religious. We don't supervise the mutual benefit organization, so I don't have much experience in overseeing them.
Follow up, Mr.
Please.
Chair. So I'm going to suggest that maybe we do a little bit more work on this. There is a group called the Condominium Working Group. Barbara Kahn's is coordinating that. And I think it may be time, and this is a good time. This is a bill that clearly shows a lot of work and a lot of thought in terms of trying to update it. But I think it may be time to look at that conflict between a very different type of nonprofit, this HOA condominium nonprofit, and what we're typically dealing with in these.
Thank you, Representative.
One additional, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Sure.
As it relates to this and unrelated to condominiums and homeowner associations, let me see if I've got this right. If the board wants to, and this passed, it could unilaterally decide not to have an annual meeting of members, send the annual report, send a written ballot to vote on membership matters, but not have that annual meeting. And there really is no way that I could discern that the membership in that case then is able to override that board decision and demand a membership meeting occur in an in-person kind of environment. Do I have that right?
Yes and no, Representative Violent and Chair Barker. Yes, if the articles and bylaws don't provide otherwise, the ability to choose that alternative to the annual meeting would be in the hands of the directors in most organizations. But it's, as Ms. Bauer said, most of the law is default law, so the articles or bylaws of the organization could provide otherwise and could require that the annual meeting be held in person. And if the members, if it's a members organization and the members wanted that provision in an existing organization, they could choose to amend the articles or bylaws to provide for an annual meeting.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
So many of these corporations, at least the ones that I'm familiar with, are operating under older documents, and they just didn't have a lot of that stuff in them. So if we've got one of those with older documents, didn't specify whether or not you had to have an annual membership meeting, then you're agreeing with me the board could unilaterally decide, regardless of what the practice had been for however long, the board could say, "Now we don't want to have an annual meeting anymore," and do away with it.
Representative Vile, Chair Barker, yes, I think that's right. I think if I were concerned about that with respect to the members, I would amend the bylaws and require an annual in-person meeting, and the members could do that.
I think that kind of flies in the face of what the abuses we see are board members who decide we really don't care what the members think. We really do want to perpetuate ourselves. And while that's not necessarily the rule, it's not all that uncommon either. And I guess I'm concerned about that and would ask that maybe we take another look at a way to protect the membership from that sort of an abusive board action.
Thank you. And Representative Violet, Chair Barker, if I may, I appreciate that, and I think we will look at that. I've heard that comment from or concern from someone else. What we're trying to balance is a concern about abusive directors with the concern that we had heard that for many organizations, the annual meeting is not effective because no one shows up and the information isn't provided to the members because it's only provided at that meeting. So I think what we'll do is take another look at it and see if we can figure out something to protect the members, because I certainly it's not our intention to harm the rights of the members and allow the directors to take those rights away.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't get me wrong. I appreciate the need to modernize this, but again, I think perhaps a belt and suspenders approach where we can give that opportunity for the board to send that out, but have a clear message in that notice be that if someone demands a meeting, we're going to have one, or something to that effect.
Great, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Leininger.
Thank you so much. As someone who's served on the board of a bunch of nonprofits and done legal work for them, I think that the idea of creating the ability for email meetings and clarifying that would really be a positive step. And it sounds like there may be a little bit of work left to do, but I think a lot of what you're trying to do in this bill is really important and positive, and I appreciate your hard work on it.
Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony, and thank you for continuing to work on that, true attorney. Come back. Ben Straka, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come and testify today. For the record, my name is Ben Straka, and I'm a policy analyst at the Freedom Foundation. I appear before you today on behalf of the foundation to voice our serious concerns with House Bill 2609. Before I get too far into it, I want to acknowledge that I have spoken to Susan Graby and others with the State Bar, Oregon State Bar, and they reached out to me and expressed the OSB's interest in addressing some of the real problems we have identified with this bill. That's very much appreciated. At least currently, we're still very concerned with House Bill 2609. As I'm sure many of you are also aware, the OSB previously had submitted a document to this committee responding to some of the concerns that we have. For the sake of clarity, I'll be responding to some of those points as I summarize our position. So whether intended to or not, the fact is House Bill 2609 does significantly weaken members' rights in a nonprofit corporation whilst giving more power and control to the corporation's directors. It's not our position that, for example, unions were on the mind of those with the Oregon State Bar. Not at all, however. Given the circumstances around which this has arisen, it's hard to ignore those concerns, and I'll spell that out for you in just a moment. But it weakens members' rights in several ways. First, House Bill 2609 would allow members' contact information to be removed from corporate membership lists, which members currently have a right to inspect. This was just addressed, as well as it's addressed in the document that I mentioned submitted by the OSB. Their response pretty much is simply that members could just give their email address instead of physical address, and they cite public safety concerns, which, of course, are serious concerns. But that doesn't even address the actual problem. The problem with this, pretty clearly in the language of the bill, is that it would allow members' contact information to be simply replaced by that of the corporation, which includes email and address, physical address, so that corporation's headquarters address could simply, for example, be worked into an authorization somewhere and populate the membership list instead of the addresses of those actual members. An easy fix to this, for example, would be, public safety concern. Why not just specify that in the bill? Specify that if there is a legitimate concern for one's safety, then that is a legitimate reason for removing one's address from the membership lists. Now, number two, House Bill 2609 would allow, as we've heard, a corporation to effectively, in some way, silence its members by eliminating the requirement to hold annual meetings. Now, the response, the initial response, at least, by the Oregon State Bar, and what you just heard was general, sort of an anecdotal account that many people don't show up to these meetings. It's inefficient. Nonetheless, it seems a bit of a low bar to set. Just because that's true with some nonprofit corporations doesn't mean that we should give any nonprofit corporation the right to simply say that we're not going to hold an annual membership meetings. And there are a couple other issues with this that I'd like to point out. Of course, posting information and supplying a ballot, I don't believe, is a good substitute for the opportunity for members to come together and participate in those corporations which get members to come to their meetings. In addition, this has membership list, so contact information implications. Currently, corporate law requires additional membership list preparation in preparation for the annual meeting, so members can request the list with a specific purpose of, prior to these meetings, communicating with other members and about, they have to request it under a proper purpose and, advocate for changes in their governance and be active members in their corporation. So this would eliminate that as well. Now, the third point. House Bill 2609 would significantly weaken, if not remove, members' rights to vote on corporate mergers. It would generally, if a merger were to go to a vote of the membership, House Bill 2609 would reduce the voting thresholds from 2/3 to a majority, a simple majority, so 50% or more. The response from the OSB initially to our concerns that has been submitted to this committee was that actually strengthens members' rights. But it's my understanding that the board of directors can submit the proposal to the membership, in which case, if they're submitting a proposal that they would like to get passed, it actually weakens the ability, or it strengthens their ability to pass that with less member scrutiny, and it makes them easier to get what they want in that regard. So generally, as a longtime advocate for individual liberty, the Freedom Foundation opposes any such policies that serve to take away individual members' rights. In addition, we are especially concerned with the specific circumstances around which this bill has arisen. It just so happens that one of the state's biggest public employee labor unions, Service Employees International Union, SEIU 503, happens to be a nonprofit corporation. I want to pause for a second and say that I don't believe that's the only one. I couldn't tell you an exact number if every labor union in the state is organized this way, but I do know that a few of the largest ones are. So it's not just SEIU 503. Now, in an ongoing lawsuit, I believe the plaintiff, of which has submitted extensive written testimony to this committee, the Oregon courts have affirmed that, yes, SEIU 503 falls under corporate law, and it has to be comply with ORS Chapter 65, which the court found it to be in repeated noncompliance of. So among other things, the union was ordered to disclose certain information, including its membership list, to a member who exercised his right under corporate law to inspect the corporate records. The court also ordered SEIU 503 to hold annual membership meetings, which it had repeatedly neglected to do. So again, whether intended to or not, House Bill 2609 would make it far easier for SEIU 503 to disregard those membership rights with which it was ordered to comply and with which it apparently would rather not comply with. So in practice, House Bill 2609 would give more power to union leaders at the expense of their members. It would decrease the union's accountability to those members, and it would allow union leaders to access corporate records their members couldn't. Lastly, it would make future changes to a union's corporate structure even simpler, which there are ongoing discussions about. So as long as this is the case, the foundation cannot support this bill. We urge the members to take a serious, hard look at it and not move it out of committee as it currently in its current form. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Representative Weil?
Mr. Chairman, have you sat down with and asked the members of the bar committee specifically to address the SEIU issues that you just enumerated for us?
I received a phone call just earlier today, a couple hours before the hearing here. And we talked generally about the issue and that they were aware of it, and they acknowledged that these were valid concerns and expressed their willingness to work to resolve them. But no, I haven't had a chance to actually sit down and go through and say, you know, do you think this is causing this? And as I said, we don't think that for the past 3 years the Oregon State Bar necessarily has had this on the mind. But it is kind of you know, it does make it easier for SEIU 503 specifically to not comply with those rights in the litigation.
I'd encourage you to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Make any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2609, and we stand adjourned. 2609, and we stand adjourned.